My name is Pat Hayden, and this is a session on Namibia titled The Light is Dimming. It's a follow-up session to the one that I did earlier this fall at Holden, which was titled Slaves of Hope. And while the Namibians are still slaves of hope, it is in fact true, they will tell you, that the light of that hope is dimming. I'd like to begin this evening by asking how many of you know something about Namibia? Anything? Can I see a show of hands? Okay, let's begin at the beginning. I've put the map here on the fireplace. I hope some of you can see it. Namibia is a country in the southern part of Africa, a very large country that has the Atlantic Ocean for its western border, the border with Angola in the north, and a little piece that sticks out here which borders on Zambia and Zimbabwe. It's bordered on the east by Botswana and by the Republic of South Africa on the south. It's also called on a lot of older maps Southwest Africa, and that's the South African's name still for Namibia. Namibia is the liberation name for the country, and that name is taken from one of the main geographical features of the country, which is the Great Namib Desert, which runs right along the Atlantic coast and is a very large desert that the only rain it gets is from the fog that comes in from the ocean. And yet it sustains an enormous wealth of life. Namibia is a very exotic country in many ways. It's been the subject of at least two National Geographic specials, one on the Great Namib Desert and the other on the Etosha Pan, which is a large area in the northern part of Namibia that is a very rich wildlife preserve. Namibia is a very arid country with a high plateau that runs down the middle of the country. It's a land primarily of small farmers and ranchers in the northern part, and along the coast and in the south, the great diamond mines that are the property of De Beers Consolidated, a South African firm. Namibia is also a country with enormous mineral resources, which accounts for a good part of its struggle. Copper, uranium, 1/6 of the world's uranium comes from Namibia. It's also a place where the lambs are grown from which Persian lamb is taken that makes the very fancy pelts and coats that women wear. Okay, Namibia has a population as close as we can estimate of about 1.5 million people in a country that's about twice the size of California and about the land area of the state of Montana. 80% of these people are black, and 10% are an officially South African designated colored population, which means mixed race, not necessarily black and white, but usually white and the native people who were aboriginal to the territory, sort of like our Native Americans here. And 10% white. The blacks are divided up into 11 tribes. The largest is the Ovambo tribe, which occupies the very most northern part of Namibia. But there are several other tribes, the Hereros, the Kavangos, the Namas, the Daras, etc., Damas. The whites are mostly German from the settlers who came there in the late 19th century, and South African, which means they're of both Dutch and English descent. There hasn't been a census in a long, long time, so the population estimate of Namibia is a real guess. Why is it important for us to be concerned about a country that's very far away in the southern part of Africa. One of the reasons is that it is the last colony in the continent of Africa, the last colony to still be controlled by a power external to itself. And so there is a great desire for liberation, both on the part of the people who live in Namibia and on the part of the rest of the African continent, that this colony should be free of the domination of others. It is also, I think, a critical story about the involvement of the U.S. government and our role in a liberation struggle and some choices that we make at the present time and in the future about how we relate to independent Africa. The story of Namibia is a political story, an economic story, and a religious story, and I'd like to talk about it in those three sections. I hope what I can do tonight is sketch enough of the history that you can have some idea of what's going on there, but also that we can have time for questions and discussion, because there are a lot of things to discuss about Namibia. Let me begin by saying that the country that is occupying Namibia is South Africa. And that's, our story begins a little bit before that, but not much. In the middle 1880s, the Germans came to southern Africa and settled in Namibia and made it their colony. When they entered World War I in 1914, they forfeited that colony because they were involved in the war in Europe, and South Africa invaded Namibia in 1915, since it was on the side of the British in the First World War and opposed, therefore, to Germany, and South Africa has never left. It has been in occupation of Namibia since 1915. When the Germans lost the war, the First World War, at the Treaty of Versailles, when the League of Nations was created, all of Germany's territories were divided up all over the world and given to different powers. The Namibia was given initially to England as a trusteeship territory, but because South Africa was a member of the Commonwealth of Great Britain at that time, England gave over the mandate of Namibia to South Africa. And it was classed as a trusteeship territory under the League of Nations. And South Africa was supposed to prepare the people eventually for the right of self-determination. They were to make annual reports to the League of Nations about their administration of this trust territory. They made their first report sometime in the 1920s. I don't know the exact date. And the League of Nations was so critical of the way that the South Africans were administering the territory that the South Africans refused to ever make another annual report to the League of Nations, although it came up every year. The story of those years from 1915 in the League of Nations until 1972 is in this little book called A Trust Betrayed, Namibia, which is put out by the United Nations and is in the Holden Library. And it's an excellent summary of what has gone on there in the last 75 years. To make a very long story short, in 1945, at the end of the Second World War, after the League of Nations had been dissolved and the United Nations was created, the trust territories under the League were all transferred to the United Nations as the successor of the League of Nations. All of them, that is, except Namibia. South Africa refused to recognize that the United Nations was the legitimate successor of the League of Nations, so it refused to participate in the United Nations with reports on the trust territory of Namibia. The UN tried to work with South Africa for a long, long time. and through all the regular political and diplomatic channels that you have, sending committees, asking for reports, inviting people to come and speak, making surveys, fact-finding commissions, etc., etc., all of which was to no avail. Finally, in 1961, the several members of the original League of Nations took a case before the International Court of Justice asking that the South Africa, since it was not accountable to the UN, turn over the trust territory to other members of the League, namely Ethiopia and Liberia. The International Court of Justice took 5 years to decide this case, and in 1966, to the great delight of South Africa and the consternation of the United Nations, by an 8-7 vote, the International Court of Justice ruled that the League had given the trust territory to South Africa as a trust by the League, and that it could not be transferred to other members of the League, other nation states. The United Nations was so upset with this decision that the General Assembly passed a resolution to terminate the League of Nations mandate to South Africa regarding Namibia and to declare Namibia a direct responsibility of the United Nations. The General Assembly passed that resolution overwhelmingly, and South Africa refused to recognize it, just declared that it didn't exist. Therefore, South Africa brought a case before the International Court of Justice asking whether or not the UN General Assembly action was legal, and the International Court of Justice took another 5 years to deliberate that decision, and in 1971 ruled that indeed the United Nations had acted responsibly and legally in 1966, and that South Africa was illegally occupying Namibia. That was in 1971. South Africa also refused to recognize and abide by that decision. Since 1971, the major things that have happened: in 1974, the General Assembly recognized the Southwest Africa People's Organization, or SWAPO, S-W-A-P-O, as the authentic representative of the Namibian people and the sole representative in the United Nations to speak for the Namibian people. SWAPO had been formed in the early 1960s as an internal, it was formed inside Namibia as a popular liberation movement and worked democratically and nonviolently inside Namibia until it was banned, which was sometime in the early 70s. I don't have the exact date. Also, with South Africa's, when South Africa began its military occupation of Namibia rather than just its economic exploitation, SWAPO formed a military arm and began to resist with military forces. So that was the beginning of the war. The war has been going on in Namibia for about 18 years. In 1978, between 1971 and 1978, there were all kinds of efforts to try to get South Africa to relinquish its hold on Namibia, to allow it to proceed towards independence, each one of them consistently blocked by the South African government. In 1978, the Security Council passed a resolution number 435, it's a very important resolution, calling for an immediate ceasefire, calling for free and fair elections in Namibia to be supervised by the United Nations, calling for a withdrawal of South African troops from Namibia back to South Africa, and calling for the release of all political prisoners. South Africa, for some interesting reason, accepted that resolution in 1978, but then refused to implement it, raised all kinds of objections to it being put into place. And the United Nations at this point was growing increasingly frustrated and disgusted with South Africa's intransigence, and were set in the Security Council to consider economic sanctions, which is one of the powers left to the United Nations when some of their other diplomatic powers don't work. Several of the major Western powers, the United States among them, Great Britain, Germany, France, and Canada, stood to lose a great deal if economic sanctions were imposed by the United Nations against South Africa for its action in Namibia. So they asked the Security Council to hold off on economic sanctions while they formed a special negotiating group of the five Western nations with the foreign ministers of each one of those nations to try to move South Africa towards acceptance of UN Resolution 435 and the elections. This is what you will often see referred to in the papers as the contact group, the Western Five. And they have been working since 1978 to try to get, again, South Africa to comply with the conditions of this resolution, 435, which calls for a ceasefire of military activities and free and fair elections, which the United Nations would supervise. The story since 1978 has been diplomatically two things. One, South Africa consistently throwing up one excuse after another regarding the implementation of this resolution, and I have the excuses if you want to know them. They're some of them quite ingenious, but all of them have been sufficient to put roadblocks in the way of the implementation of that resolution. And they have escalated the military effort. In 1981, it was estimated that there were about 50,000 South African troops in Namibia and that they were spending approximately $1 million a day to fight the war in Namibia. That's South African money spent in Namibia. What I learned at the conference last week is that the troop strength inside Namibia has increased to about 100,000 South African troops, and that South Africa is spending about $2.8 million a day to finance the war in Namibia. The Western Contact Group has, in fact, been able to achieve nothing since 1978 in terms of getting the South Africa to move closer to the implementation of the resolution.
Do you think they want to accomplish anything?
Well, no. I mean, well, it's hard to say. The major roadblock since the election of Mr. Reagan has been the U.S. insistence on linking an extraneous issue the Namibians maintain with the holding of free and fair elections in Namibia, and that is the withdrawal of Cuban troops that are stationed in Angola, which is the neighboring country to the north. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But the South Africans have been able to use the U.S. Linkage of these two issues to successfully limit any kind of activity, any kind of movement on Namibian independence since 1980.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering about who's fighting for the Namibians right now?
Okay.
Has the UN been able to put in troops?
No, Namibia right now is an occupied nation by South Africa, and the people who are fighting for the Namibian people, are the Southwest Africa People's Organization, which is a guerrilla group fighting a guerrilla war. The Southwest Africa People's Organization is outside the country of Namibia. It has been banned in Namibia. Its constitution has been banned. Its leadership has been banned. It's all political meetings have been banned for SWAPO to hold inside Namibia. So they fight a guerrilla war.
And how are they financed to counteract with the South Africans?
Well, they're financed by a great number of countries. The guns largely come from the East Bloc countries, from East Germany, from from the Soviet Union, from now Zimbabwe, after it won its independence. Economic assistance comes not only from the East Bloc nations, but from all of the European nations. I think the United States is the only nation that is not giving assistance of an economic sort to SWAPO. The United Nations is also strongly supporting the economic and educational development of SWAPO through the establishment of the United Nations Institute. The UN Institute in Lusaka, Zambia, where Namibian exiles are being trained for civil service jobs to be able to manage the government when it becomes independent.
Hasn't the U.S. press also characterized SWAPO as a terrorist?
Yes.
Communist?
In the press, you will almost always see SWAPO characterized as a Marxist terrorist guerrilla organization. And it is certainly true that SWAPO has some Marxist elements in it, but it is not true that it is a Marxist terrorist organization. Bishop Dumeni, whose picture is here, and who is the Lutheran bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Ovambo Kavango Church, has said, "SWAPO is our sons and daughters, our brothers and sisters, our mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles. They have been born and baptized and confirmed by us and married by us." Several Lutheran pastors are members of SWAPO and active in it both inside and outside of Namibia. It is genuinely a people's army, a people's political organization. But you never hear about that in the United States establishment press.
Yeah. Is it because of the communist ties that the United States won't send in troops? Is that why, or because of our own policies?
Well, the United States is backing South Africa in this case, so we don't need to send in troops. What we are doing is supplying South Africa with a great deal of money through bank loans. They got a $1 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund last year, South Africa did, and the largest power in the IMF is the United States. They also have received several million dollars of loans from U.S. banks, Citibank, Chase Manhattan, others. That's why part of the resistance effort is to try to force banks in the United States to stop making loans to South Africa. Many people say that's the last nonviolent alternative that we have for trying to get South Africa to stop their war in Namibia.
Pat, are the Cubans still in Angola, and how does Angola
figure into
this? Are they part of South Africa, or are they not? Are they independent? They're independent.
Angola is an independent nation. It was formerly a colony of Portugal, and it got its independence in the early 1970s after a long struggle. It doesn't seem like any nation in Africa has been ever. I think there maybe were one or two. Ghana was given its independence, but most of them have had to fight for it. And when Angola became independent, there were two competing parties in Angola. One of them took over the government, and the other one became a rebel group inside Angola, fighting to take the governing control away from the one that was in power. The rebel group is called UNITA, UNITA, and is headed by a man named Jonas Savimbi. South Africa came with money and with materiel and with men to support Savimbi in his attempt to overthrow the government of Angola. So Angola asked Cuba to send troops in to help Angolan government troops protect Angolan territory from the Angolan rebels, Savimbi's rebels. And it's that's why the Cubans are in Angola right now, at the request of the Angolan government and to help in the civil war which is going on inside
of
Angola.
They're still there. There's approximately, what, 2,000 troops, or is there more, or do you know?
I don't know how many. There are not a great number. They're not a great number. But they're there at the request of the Angolan government. And what the United States has done is to say that these troops should be sent home before free and fair elections can take place in Namibia. The reasoning being that the United States links all of the Reagan administration links almost every struggle in the United States, in the world right now, to a struggle between the Soviet Union and the United States. And so since Cuba is an ally of the Soviet Union, it sees Cuban presence in Angola as Russian presence in southern Africa and wants it out before Namibian elections can take place. And the Namibians say this is a completely extraneous issue to and obscures the fact that South Africa is illegally occupying Namibia, is refusing international opinion and the actions of the United Nations to hold free and fair elections and to allow the Namibian people the right to vote to choose their own government. The reason South Africa doesn't want to give Namibia the right to choose their own government are three. One, South Africa is taking a great deal of money out of Namibia. It would have to be able to afford a $2.8 million a day war effort. And it is in the uranium and the diamond mines. Secondly, Namibia is seen as South Africa's fifth colony and as a buffer state between independent Africa and its own black struggle, the apartheid struggle in Africa, in South Africa itself. It does not want to have an independent Namibia on its borders. I think I said three, but those are the two main reasons that South Africa does not and will not let go of control of Namibia.
Okay, so what's the United States? Our position then is not one of justice in Namibia. It's one of economic, because we've got money in South Africa. All the money that's coming out of Namibia, is that, am I on the right track?
Yeah. Well, it's support of South Africa, which is illegally in Namibia. It's support of the racist government of South Africa, which is imposing the apartheid legislation. Apartheid means separate development. They carved up Namibia, as they have South Africa, into 11 tribal areas, and keep the tribes separate from one another in government, in economics, in education, in all kinds of ways, to try to encourage tribal rivalries rather than allowing the country to seek to be a unified nation. And the United States is supporting South Africa's effort. The United States also has some economic involvements in Namibia. There are some U.S. corporations doing business in Namibia.
Which ones,
Pam? Let's see if I can remember. Newmont Mining Corporation is one of them. The U.S. is primarily involved in the copper mines in Namibia. There's a big one at Sumeb, and Newmont Mining is one of them, and there's another one whose name I've forgotten.
Is it primarily the economic thing that the United States is trying to protect, or is it the fear of the communist kind of threat? Is that, or both, or what?
Well, it's both things, and it's also just... This is a subjective statement on my part. It's an utter lack of awareness of the sensitivities of the Namibian people to be an independent nation.
I mean, you haven't touched on the oppression of the Namibian people and the philosophies of the South African people regarding the black and white race and all of that. Are you going to move into that?
Yeah, I will move into that very quickly. There's a lot here. I have some books which I brought back from the conference about apartheid, what it is and what it does. And I would invite you to come and look at these. two books, Children Under Apartheid, Women Under Apartheid, and another one called Apartheid, The Facts. These are put out by an international organization called the International Defense and Aid Fund for Southern Africa. And we'll tell you what the situation is in South Africa, which is very similar to the situation in Namibia. The same laws are in effect in both places. How do you begin? South Africa completely controls the government and the economy, the education and the health efforts in Namibia. Most Namibians who work, most of the Ovambo people who live in the north, whose families are in the north, work as contract laborers 11 months out of the year in the diamond and uranium mines. They leave their wives and families in the north and they go to the south to work, where they live in barracks for 11 months of the year. They are given one month to go home and see their families. They are paid wages ranging from 54 cents to $1.79 an hour in the diamond mines. They have no health protection either in the diamond mines or in the uranium, working in the uranium mines. In education, they have what they call Bantu education, which is a particular education for blacks that's separate from that of whites. The South Africans spend in Namibia $207 per black student and $1,600 per white student. These are 1983 statistics. In 1982, there were 1,376 high school graduates in Namibia. 376 of them were black. 20 students went on to university. In Namibia, there is no post-secondary training. You must leave Namibia to get a university education. You can go to South Africa and go into the black universities in South Africa, or you must leave the continent of Africa altogether and go abroad to study. Because Namibians carry South African passports, they are not welcome in the other nation states of Africa, where they might be able to have access to educational facilities, unless they are Namibian refugees, in which case they are welcome in Angola and Zambia and other places. But they don't have passports, South African
passports.
What's
the nature of the black university education in South Africa? I would suspect it would not be...
It's very poor.
And that would prepare them for any kind of leadership or...
No. No. It's very poor. Just one example. One of the students that came under the program that I worked with was a woman who had done all of the training that she could do in South Africa to be an X-ray technician. And she wanted to be able to either teach X-ray technology or to administer an X-ray department in a hospital. And she had to leave South Africa and come to the United States in order to get the education to qualify her to do either one of those things. As long as she, with the highest amount of training she could get in South Africa, it was to be an X-ray technician at the most basic level.
Getting more training here, would she be hired in South Africa? Or?
That's a question. Maybe.
Would she be hired in any case?
Yeah, well, she would be hired. She might not be hired in a position for which she was qualified. But she would then have the qualifications when Namibia becomes independent to be able to either teach or administer in that setting. What else? Health. We'll listen to a little bit about health conditions from my friend that I heard and met again when I was at the conference last week. But the statistics say that $211 are spent on whites for every $34 that are spent on blacks. One of the other things that's happened most recently in Namibia is that South Africa has created tribal armies of all these 11 tribal groups and formed them in 1980 into a territory force, a Southwest Africa territory force, passed a conscription law that all young people over the age of 15 had to serve in the military to fight against their own brothers and uncles and fathers and cousins in SWAPO. In January, after that law was passed, some 50,000 young people left Namibia to become refugees rather than to serve under military conscription. Several others who were caught, if you refuse to enter the military service, you can be caught and punished. And there have been several cases of people supposedly committing suicide when they were taken into the military barracks because they refused to serve.
Where did the 50,000 people go?
Angola, Zambia, where most of the refugee camps are. And when you hear, as we do often, sometimes in our press, about South Africa's raids into Angola and that they've wiped out another SWAPO terrorist base, usually what they've wiped out is a refugee camp. One of the major raids was in May of 1978, the raid on Kasinga, Angola, where the South Africans came in with planes and dropped bombs and then dropped paratroopers with bayonets and guns, who literally slaughtered 800 Namibians, most of them women and children and old men who had fled. It was not a military camp at all.
What documentation is there for that story outside of the U.S. press?
For the Kasinga massacre? The documentation of some of the people who were there in Kasinga who came back
was it reported on a press, a European press agency, or how does news like that get out?
The South Africans report it, and it comes out as a South African report, and then it also came out as a SWAPO report. And then some of the survivors were captured by the South Africans and brought back to Namibia. Some of them, again, hard to know exactly how the South African government works in some of these ways, were released. One of them was at the conference last week, a young man who's a member of the Lutheran Church, the Ovambo Church, who's studying in the United States now. And he shared his story of what happened in Kasinga. There are several pictures that were taken by people who were at the scene, who arrived shortly after the massacre. But it's only one. There are incursions, as they're called in the South African press, into Angola all the time, with loss of life to people who are there.
In South Africa, do they, the ruling class is primarily white, is it not?
Yes.
Okay, now, what do they have, do they impose sanctions against blacks and whites and divisions thereof?
Yes. The apartheid system seeks to completely separate whites from blacks and to control blacks as a labor source to serve whites in South Africa. They have areas both in South Africa and in Namibia which are called black areas and white areas and colored areas. You may live only in the area in which your color is allowed, and to move from that area to any other area you must have a legal document. All South Africans, not Namibians, all South Africans carry a passbook, which is, they must have on themselves at all times.
The black ones.
Mm-hmm. Which says where they may be allowed to stay. And if they're caught without their passbook or in an area that's illegal for them, then they are severely punished, imprisoned, etc. They're not citizens. Blacks are not citizens of South Africa.
If Namibia,
under the apartheid legislation.
If Namibia is able to rule themselves effectively and win the war, will they be effectively ruling their ruling class, will it be, remain white?
No.
10% is completely white in Namibia, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Where would they fall into the scheme of this thing under the Namibian government?
Well, the government of Namibia, one of the other reasons South Africa doesn't want Namibia to have free and fair elections is because their own secret police say, and it's quite true, that SWAPO would win a free and fair election to be the representative of the people to be able to form the government in Namibia. SWAPO has said over and over again that it will welcome whites into the government, that it will include them in the economy and the future of Namibia, and that it has no interest at all in doing to whites what has been done to blacks. Of course, there's a great deal of fear on the part of whites that they really mean this. But they have consistently said that they're not interested in genocide of whites. Yeah.
Are you saying that in the United States' support of South Africa, that the United States is actually going against UN policy in doing that?
Yes.
And can't the UN somehow, can't they act as some kind of, can't they do something about that?
Well, it's very difficult because in the Security Council, where a lot of these things are discussed, the United States is one of the four nations that has veto power over any resolution of the United Nations. So they must act by persuasion. That's all they can do. That's one of the reasons. Well, I'd like to move on in and talk a little bit about the role of the church in Namibia, because that's the reason I got into this, and part of the reason that I'm so committed to the struggle for Namibian independence. In the 1800s, when the Germans came, so did the missionaries. The German missionaries came to the middle part of the country, to around the capital city, Windhoek, and the Finnish missionaries came to the northern part of Namibia, to the Ovambo land, and Christianized the people, so that I've read the statistics that 100% of the Ovambos are Christians, and 100% of the Ovambos are Christians and Lutherans. 50% of the whole population of Namibia is Lutheran. Other religious groups in Namibia include Roman Catholic, Anglican, and African Methodist Episcopal. But by far the majority of the people, some in Namibia, are Lutheran, which is how we come to be involved, us who call ourselves a part of the Lutheran Church. The Lutheran Church from the very beginning has been one of the forces for democratic rule or democratic education in the country. Church councils are elected. The bishop is elected. They meet with representatives to decide about youth work and men's work and women's work. And it is now the only force that seeks to work cooperatively with all of the tribes together and with other religious groups inside of Namibia. I should say that the largest Lutheran group is in the very north of Namibia, the Ovambo Kavango Church, which has about 250,000 members. And this is where the most of the fighting is going on in the northern part of Namibia. And the bishop of that church is Cleophas Dumeni, a Namibian. And he and his church have spoken out very strongly against the South African occupation and in favor of the United Nations resolution and elections. They have written letters to the South African Prime Minister asking for the United Nations resolution to be implemented. They have consistently in their church press asked for peace and stability to come. They've protested a lot of the South African military violence that's being done to the Namibian people.
twice in the last 10 years, they have suffered, well, they've suffered a lot, but twice, the South Africans, well, I don't know that it's the South Africans, the speculation is that it is, the church press has been blown up, that publishes school textbooks and Christmas greeting cards and church hymnals and the newspaper that goes from Elok out to all of the congregations. And this, the most recent time was in November 1980, and they speculate that the reason the press was blown up was because about 6 months earlier they had published in the newspaper a hit list which had been found on the body of a dead South African soldier containing 25 names of the prominent business people and pastors in the northern part of Namibia, including Bishop Dumeni. And they speculate that the reason the press was blown up was in retaliation for publishing this list. There have been several such lists found, but that one they published. Does this make any sense? Mm-hmm.
Okay. They published this list to warn the, well, not only to warn, but to make it publicly known that these people were on a hit list. So did it work effectively?
Oh, yes, it did. Bishop Dumeni said that's our best life insurance. Mm-hmm. No, because we asked him why he published such a list. Wasn't that a very dangerous thing to do? And he just laughed and said, perhaps, but that it was their life insurance. Because they, one of the things was that the first four names on that list had been crossed off, and all of those people had met their death in the preceding 2 or 3 months, accidentally. The conditions under which the Namibian people live right now are really very depressing. As I said, the South Africans have a very large military presence there. Most of it is in the north. They have a dusk to dawn curfew in the north of Namibia. Anything that moves after dark is shot, no questions asked. So that wherever you are when the sun goes down, that's where you stay. And if you have the misfortune to be pregnant and having your baby at night, or have a heart attack or something, you may not go next door or anywhere to get aid. You must stay until the light comes. They have surrounded a lot of the villages with barbed wire. Bishop Dumeni has a tank pointed at the front door of his house. There are military men stationed around the church offices in Onipa. The church parishes are very close to the major military bases in South Africa. The South Africans and the Southwest African Territorial Force, the black tribal armies, have taken to intimidating parishes, church services, pastors. Pastors have been arrested and tortured. Some of them have disappeared, and the congregations do not know what's become of them. There's a publication here that you might want to read, which I found very interesting. It's a speech by Sam Nujoma, who's the head of the Southwest Africa People's Organization. That's a picture of Sam. To the European Economic Community Parliamentary Group in Brussels, Belgium, in September 1982. And he reports one of these acts of intimidation in Namibia, which we learned much before this speech in a direct telex message from Bishop Dumeni, because he was present when this happened. On May 16th, South African soldiers interrupted at the same time two Sunday worship services at Ilambe Parish, 48 kilometers east of Ondangwa, and at Onanyena Parish, approximately 15 kilometers west of Ilambe. At both places, the racist soldiers got into the church and stopped the worship service under the pretext of looking for SWAPO activists. They turned the two church services into total confusion, as they surrounded the two churches and ordered all the people to leave the two church buildings. They also threatened to shoot anyone refusing to leave the church or trying to run away. All the men were assembled, interrogated, and some beaten up. Bishop Dumeny reported this and more details of this when he talked in both in his message and when he visited the United States the next time and talked with us. He protested this treatment to the South African Defense Force and received an apology. He had been told by the South African commander that whenever there was any specific act of intimidation, that he should let them know. So he went and let them know, and they officially reprimanded the soldiers who'd been involved in this Ilombe incident. We heard at the conference last week that this past Christmas there were also several acts of intimidation of the churches, including during Christmas Mass at a Roman Catholic church. The priest had just finished giving his sermon and had sat down when a rifle shot was fired through the pulpit. It would have killed him had he still been standing there, but he was sitting down, and it caused utter pandemonium in the congregation. And they were all set to flee, but he encouraged them to remain calm and to continue to the worship service. If they were going to be assaulted, they would be assaulted. But these are not isolated incidences that happen and then stop.
I'm surprised the bishop is allowed to travel to, like, come to the States.
Well, part of that is that he has a South African passport, and he is so well known in the international community that if the South Africans attempted to interfere with his leaving, it would be very embarrassing. Because you see, the South Africans say they're in Namibia to protect the Namibian people
from
the communist terrorists who are SWAPO. So there, things are a little inconsistent. How can they be protecting the people and in refusing to let the bishop travel? They have done some other things to the church. The missionaries, the Finnish missionaries who worked in the hospitals, there are a couple of hospitals in the north and several clinics. And there were several Finnish doctors and nurses, medical personnel there. When their visas expired, South Africa refused to renew them. And so there has been a continuing shortage of skilled people. At the last I heard, which was a year ago, there was one doctor at the hospital in Onipa. The other doctor was under house arrest. And a third doctor was imprisoned, had disappeared. I have several pieces of information here which I won't read because I'd like to leave time to ask questions, but let me just share this piece of paper with you. This is a report from Harare, Zimbabwe, that's dated January 7th, 1984, and appeared in the main Windhoek newspaper in Namibia. It's a report that Bishop Dumeny gave to the Lutheran World Federation pre-assembly All-Africa Conference in Harare, Zimbabwe, about the conditions in Namibia. And in it, he's talking about the number of people who are being held incommunicado, who have disappeared, the abductions, the torture, the fear and the mistrust that is growing, and the other conditions under which the church is having to operate now. The conference that let me just share also then the resources that you have as Americans for finding out what's going on in Namibia besides the U.S. press are several. But two of them that are put out by Lutheran sources are this one, Dateline Namibia, which comes out of the Lutheran Church in America Communication Offices in New York, comes out several times a year, is a newsletter that publishes, translates and publishes some of the articles that are in the church press in Namibia, Omkhweto, the Elok Church newspaper. And also reports regularly on those people who come from Namibia, which is how we get a good deal of our information. The Namibia newsletter from Wartburg Seminary is part of the Namibia Concerns Committee, which is a group of students and faculty and staff at Wartburg who have Namibia as a special concern. And they also report regularly on developments in Namibia. Both of these publications, I think, are free, unless you want to make a contribution to help them with their mailing costs, and they'll be very happy to put you on the mailing list. The Lutheran churches have begun a special advocacy program this year. It started in August of this last year to try to educate Americans about what's going on in Namibia and to encourage us to become involved in both political and economic advocacy, especially during this election year. And it was these two reasons, education and advocacy, that this conference was held, that I went to last week, sponsored by the churches. There is a great deal of information that you can get if wherever you are, those of you who are going to be leaving Holden, you can get speakers and films. The churches are providing travel monies for people from Namibia who are in the United States studying to come and visit congregations and parishes to speak, to tell the story of Namibia. But it's very important, I think, that we who have the opportunity to vote this year do so on behalf of our Namibian brothers and sisters who do not have that opportunity. And in that regard, I've got a couple of documents here which are fairly recent. One is the crisis in U.S. policy towards Southern Africa, which is a summary of U.S. policy, very easy to read and with some of the basic documents. And the other is a research publication on the Democratic presidential candidates address black foreign policy concerns. And in there, all of the Democratic candidates are asked to state their position on the Cuban troop issue, linking it with Namibian elections, their position on supporting economic sanctions in the United Nations against South Africa, and other issues of concern to the Namibians, the implementation of Resolution 435. Are there any other questions? Yeah.
I'd like to ask you about the CIA. There's been some indication that the CIA has been down in this area and on the side of the South. Is that correct, South Africa side?
Well, there, what I do know about, or I've heard and read about, is CIA support for Jonas Savimbi in Angola, for the UNITA rebels.
To get the Cubans out of
Angola. Well, to overthrow the Angolan government, yeah. One of the interesting facts is that Angola has a lot of Western economic corporations in it, like Gulf Oil. And they've been trying to talk the Reagan administration into stopping this ridiculous policy and cooperating more with Angola. But they haven't succeeded yet either.
Mm-hmm. What is the importance of the Cuban troops being there now? I mean, why can't there be a negotiation about that? I don't understand why that's... It seems like that's a really key negotiation point, that if the Cubans would leave, there could be free elections.
That's what the United States is saying. And the Namibians are saying that's not our issue. The issue is South Africa is in Namibia illegally, and they are refusing to implement Resolution 435 of the United Nations. And the presence of Cuban troops in Angola has absolutely nothing to do with Namibian independence.
What are they doing there, though? Why are they there?
They're supporting the government of Angola in their civil war. Inside Angola, the other side in the civil war, the non-Angolan government side, is being supported by South Africa.
So how in effect are we assisting South Africa? Is it through presently by dealing with them and our banks lending them money, or?
Well, we're supporting them in several ways. We're supporting them through our foreign policy decision on Namibia.
I mean, not that we're actively involved. I mean, we don't have troops on either side. It's
no.
Passive. You're talking about passive.
Well, no, I'm not talking about passive. We're very actively in support of South Africa. And I haven't talked about that tonight, but we are under the Reagan administration, several things have happened in support of South Africa that have never happened before. One of them is an enormous increase in the amount of aid that is being sent to them under the guise that it's for commercial purposes, but that in fact can be used for military purposes. In contravention of a congressional arms embargo, we are also making these bank loans and economic loans. We are supporting South African efforts in the United States to raise billions of dollars through the sale of Krugerrands, which is their gold in the United States. We have allowed South African military people to come and visit our military establishments in the United States to receive training, to have consultation with our ambassador at the United Nations and with high-ranking officials in the Defense Department, the first time that that's ever been allowed in the last several years. So we're not at all passively supporting.
Okay, what's our interest then? What is our interest? Is it number one, defense of the United States and fear of the Russians? Or Soviets?
That's
number one.
That's the Reagan administration line, that South Africa is a bulwark against Russian occupation or Russian influence in South Africa. What that position refuses to recognize is that South Africa is a racist government that is oppressing its own millions of black people, and that all of the black national states around South Africa are not communist Russian stooges. They are independent nations.
Okay, secondly then, our interest would be economic.
Mm-hmm.
And then falling third would be justice.
Well, I don't even think justice is a concern of the United States government at this point. I think that's another reason you will often hear is that South Africa possesses strategic materials necessary for U.S. defense, minerals and such, like the uranium from Namibia. But that is not necessarily it's true that they do possess strategic minerals. It's not true that there aren't other places that we can have access to.
What is so bizarre is this paranoia of the communists as the great evil, in, you know, which defers then to the evil of apartheid, which is so obvious. And, you know, but this threat of this looming communist thing, you know, that we're gonna sustain apartheid because of the wickedness of communism.
Well, it's a real question whether the issue, I mean, how you see the issue in Southern Africa, whether you see the communist threat.
Well, I mean, it's looking through Reagan,
yes,
you know, his whole thing.
Or whether you see the issue is one of racism and is one of injustice,
mm-hmm,
on a very large scale. More and more people, both at this conference last week and in the last things that I've read, are comparing South Africa right now to Nazi Germany. And drawing the parallels between their system of racism and apartheid with the system of master race that was at the base of Nazi Germany. The thing that is just horrifying, I think, that we don't know, or we don't lift up to our own consciousness as Americans, is that South Africa calls itself a democratic nation, a Christian nation, and justifies apartheid on the basis of theological and Christian bases. Yes.
I was going to ask about
that. It's not because it's they. It's just economic and political. They really believe, biblically and theologically, that racism is the will of God.
Yeah.
And
we used to believe that.
Sure, we did.
That's right. We did. We fought a war in our own country over that issue.
And that's it. Are you also saying, though, that the church in Namibia itself is unanimously in opposition to what's happening?
Yes.
As far as that?
Yes. All there is a small white German Lutheran church that has even been disowned by the Lutheran churches in Germany because of its far right support of apartheid. But all of the churches in Namibia are unanimously in opposition.
But the churches in South Africa are turning it all around and saying, is it the churches that are doing the theological stuff?
Well, the largest church in South Africa, which is the Dutch Reformed Church, is the church of the white Afrikaner in South Africa. And it is the one that theologically is supporting apartheid. Some interesting developments on that. The international body to which that church belongs last August in Toronto declared apartheid a heresy and called upon the Dutch Reformed churches in South Africa to take steps to disassociate itself with that heresy. When the church assembly was held in September following that decision in Toronto, they appointed a committee to study the matter. So that's where it is. But there are other churches in South Africa, notably the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Church, who are very strongly in opposition to the South African government's apartheid policies. The Lutheran Church is opposed, but is a very, I mean, the Black Lutheran Church is opposed, but acts in a very timid kind of way politically. The White Lutheran Church in South Africa has been addressed by the International Lutheran Body and its meeting in Tanzania in August of 1977, also on the issue of apartheid, declaring that it was a matter of the confession of faith, that they declare that apartheid was not part of the faith stance of the Lutheran Church. And the white South Africans in white Lutheran South Africans have been very upset with that decision on the part of the international Lutheran community. And it'll be interesting to see what happens at Budapest this summer in relation to that question.
So that on their own, the white Lutherans in South Africa are supporting the apartheid?
Yes. De facto, if not de jure, yes. Yeah, in practice, they are. Although they will tell you they're not.
I'd be real interested in reading the paper that has the democratic positions and stuff, but realistically I don't see Namibia being a central issue in the upcoming campaign. And how then do you hold politicians accountable to an issue like Namibia when inevitably the press is going to make the economy, Lebanon, some of the other issues, the ones that we're going to hear about, and things like Namibia and Philippines and other areas of tremendous strife are just going to be lost?
Well, that's a really good question. My own hope is that even if the United States press does not pick up Namibia as an issue, that U.S. Lutherans will pick up Namibia as an issue and demand from all of their candidates, congressional as well as presidential, a statement about how they would act in terms of the Namibian and South African issues, because they tie up in a larger issue with the economic development of Africa, of independent Africa, and how the United States is going to be supportive of that whole continent and its effort to achieve economic development and political stability and all the rest of it. And to make those questions a part of Lutheran discussions in churches, in congregations, and to get people registered and to tell them that they have a choice about the people that they vote for. I mean, I know it's not going to be a major issue in terms of the U.S. press, but I guess that doesn't mean we need to just sit back and say, okay, we'll just
let it be. What would be the recommended course of action, you know, assuming that America looks beyond its nose, beyond its strategic interests, and develops an interest in the area? What would be the policy of the U.S., or what would be the proper policy to adhere to in dealing with the situation?
Well, I think the first policy that it would be good to adhere to is to remove this link between the Cuban troops in Angola and free and fair elections in Namibia, and to throw U.S. support behind the United Nations effort to implement Resolution 435, a ceasefire, a free and fair election supervised by the UN.
But the UN has never, you know, the UN is not a very, it's not a body capable of enforcing its own, you know, they've passed 400 different things, and I don't think anything's been implemented by the UN.
Well, no, but it's I have a quote here from Peter Kachavivi, who is the Minister of Information for SWAPO. And Kachavivi spoke at Wartburg in October this last year. And he said the U.S. government's insistence on the so-called linkage between the withdrawal of Cuban troops from Angola and the holding of free elections in Namibia is the major problem of the moment. In this way, the USA has placed itself in the wrong camp and is supporting South Africa's continued oppression in Namibia. So to stop that, I mean, just even to stop that would be a major step forward. The UN has in place the machinery to go in to supervise the ceasefire and the withdrawal of South African forces and the supervision of the elections. A group of international people who've been...
A UN peacekeeping force like in Lebanon?
Well, not a peacekeeping force, but a UN transitional assistance group, it's called, to help with the supervision of the elections. And nation states have offered people to be involved in that. In fact, even some U.S. people have been offered to be involved in that. I have to share, but I've gone on for a long time, so maybe I shouldn't. But if you want to listen to it, you may. About 10 minutes of a friend of mine who did come to the conference last week, a man who is a student in the United States now in public health, who had just returned. Our conference started on a Friday. He'd just come back the preceding Sunday from Namibia. He'd been there for 5 weeks from the 16th of December. And his main concern was to find out about health conditions in Namibia. And he reported that that the war effort inside Namibia has created an enormous refugee problem. Many people are crowded together in a small area in the north. The population of the black township outside of the capital, Windhoek, has doubled in the 3 years since he's been there. There is very little sanitation facilities, very little in the way of housing and other kinds of necessities for these people. Bubonic plague, measles, and malaria are epidemic now in Namibia, because of the conditions caused by the war and the refugee crowding situation. And he reported also that people are beginning to despair, that they don't see any progress in the negotiations, any movement towards the elections. They really don't see, they just ask whether there's any reason to hope. Various kinds of intimidations are becoming more intense in Namibia itself, and his one of the things he said was the situation has not changed in Namibia. If anything, it's gotten worse. So it's, it was a very, in that sense, it was a very sobering conference. And the Namibians say to us that we can do several things for them. The first one is to pray for them. That's always what Bishop Dumeni asks, and all of the church leaders ask, is to pray for them, to pray for them, for their congregations, for the South African oppressors, for peace to come, and then to work for it through political advocacy, through information, through economic activity, and to support them here in the United States. There's a lot of support that needs to be given for Namibian exiles and refugees. Quite frankly, the East Bloc countries are a lot more hospitable to them in basic things like giving them education and living facilities than is the West, the United States especially. And yet they've said, Namibians have said that English is going to be the major language of their country when they become independent, and that they hope and plan to follow a democratic form of government. So we have everything to gain by being on the right side of this one, and a lot to lose by not.
Pat, can I say something?
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to put this thing in proper perspective in the foreign policy that our government has right now, and it's known by theologians and it's many authors and generally known that our interest in foreign policy, number one, paramount, is protection of the people, number one. Number two is what's economically advantageous to us. And number three is global justice. It seems to me that we've got that backwards, that it should be just reversed. And until we get that thing turned around, and we as Christians can make ourselves aware of these types of things and work from that direction, we'll get that thing turned around, because particularly with a country like ours, which was formed by Christians to begin with, we've really gotten off, way off, sidetracked. And there's just entirely too much emphasis on material things and living forever and protecting our little world. And I think we've got it backwards. I know we've got it backwards. Mm-hmm.
We do. That's a good way to say that.
Well, and even, I don't want to listen to your tape, so I'll make this short, but just, it's foolish to think that we can separate concern for global justice with concern for protecting our own selves, because the further we get this paranoid self-protection at the expense of global justice, the riskier our status becomes.
Absolutely, because we are creating enemies.
Yeah, I don't think we realize how hated we are by the rest of the
world.
Oh,
and you think, well, what in the world does it matter? Why do these people hate us?
We also are eroding our own liberties, which is a...
And our own philosophies, what
we
believe in.
In our own country, which is a very frightening development, I think. Jean?
I was wondering what you suggest, if people here would want to go back to their congregations and give some of the... What I'd be interested in, especially, is what struck me a lot was the statistics that you gave on injustice. You know, some things that people can see that there is this kind of injustice. Is there something that you could suggest that contains that?
Yes, these newsletters. I mean, there's not... You can have as much information as you want. You can also have as little. The Lutheran churches are better organized to present information on this issue than on any other global justice issue that I know of. So they can make available films and fact sheets so that you can have all the information that you need. And I'll be glad to give you those addresses there somewhere in this case.
So if you write down, like, know what you need there.
Right, right. And to do this not only in your own congregation, but ecumenically if you can, and to involve other Lutheran congregations. I mean, it's going to take just passing the word. That's really what it involves.
Okay.